Hello, this is Mike Weaver. If you've already listened to Unit 1 of Achiever Training, welcome back. If perhaps you skipped over Unit 1 and preferred to start with Unit 2, which gets into understanding of the Achiever, I would suggest that at some time that it's convenient, you go back and listen to Unit 1. I believe the background information on personality and behavior is quite valuable, and particularly when combined with Units 2, 3, and 4. In this unit, we're going to talk about the role of the Achiever and how it fits in with selecting and positioning employees in general. Even before I do that, I'd like to provide you a little background. I was first exposed to the Achiever in 1974. The Achiever itself, the initial design of the Achiever, had only been completed within the year prior to that. I was one of the first few people trained with the Achiever. One of the people that was in the training process with me was the late Milt Cotter. Cotter went on to acquire the Achiever rights from the designers. The designers were two industrial psychologists, Dr. John Moore and Dr. John Shirley. My instruction was with Dr. John Shirley, one of the most fascinating people that I've met, and who obviously knows the Achiever inside out. I owe him throughout my career a debt because of that particular training session. Milt Cotter went on to acquire the rights to the Achiever and began a company called, now called, Candidate Resources Incorporated, CRI, based in Arlington, Texas. Milt passed away several years ago. The company is now in the able hands of his son, Eric Cotter. So I owe Milt a debt of gratitude. He certainly did a lot to help me build Achievement Associates Incorporated, and I still enjoy a very pleasant and rewarding relationship with Eric Cotter. When the Achiever was designed in 73-74, it was the first profiling instrument designed primarily for business and industry, as it turned out, also government. Up until that time, the kind of profiling that was done was not actually profiling. What was being used were psychological tests, the Minnesota Multiphasic, the 16PF, and so forth. This is a severe case of overkill, because those instruments were designed to really, among other things, assess the potential for aberrant behavior, etc. That is not what business and industry needed. What business and industry needed was a very practical measure of behavioral tendencies and hopefully some practical mental aptitudes, so that in hiring employees, they would have some sense of whether or not the person could perform the work required in a successful way. Personality profiling is aimed more at telling us whether or not the person has enough interpersonal skills to be an effective salesperson. It tells us whether or not we can trust the honesty and the candor of the employee in working with other employees or with customers. It tells us whether or not a given employee, when they call in sick, really are sick, or it's a cover. Those are the kind of practical things that organizations need to know about people. And that's the role of the Achiever. Would also remind you, and this is was covered in Unit Number 1, keep in mind that the Achiever is, to the best of our knowledge, the only profiling instrument that combines practical mental aptitudes, personality dimensions, and the ability to measure whether or not the results of a particular profile are valid or not, or to the degree that the profile is valid. Also, to remind you that in the last 8 years, 1.8 million people have profiled with the Achiever, and that breaks out to $18,750 a month. So the Achiever is a proven, very, very valid personality profiling instrument. Beyond the scope of this discussion, in the Achiever training, but the Achiever must, of course, meet all of the federal, state, and local requirements and regulations as regards reliability, validity, and does it really measure what it claims to measure? And I assure you that it does. So that's all by way of background. Turn to the PDF files that were included with the Achiever Training Program package. And if you would, take a look at page 4. That is the fabled selection funnel. And picking people really begins with recruiting, which can be an extremely challenging exercise in itself. By doing some preliminary interviewing, perhaps even on the phone, and reviewing a submitted resume, one gets a sense of the initial potential fit for the position. Keep in mind a note of caution in resumes. Unfortunately, many resumes are, if not falsified, or at least exaggerated. So one must take any resume with a grain of salt. The second step in the selection funnel, as you'll see in page 4, is reference checking. Back to the organization that the person has worked in previously or where they're previously employed. Keep in mind here also that skill here makes a big difference in the kind of data you get back. In many human resource departments, their general answer to almost anything you say is that he or she was a good employee. People are concerned about legislation, so many times legislation that doesn't exist, but they are concerned about giving information on past employees. Where possible, it's very advisable to talk to people that actually supervised the person in mind or worked with them, so that you have first-hand information on the nature of the person, their personality, how successful they were in the role, etc. Reference checking is extremely important. Some typical questions that, and we do a lot of interview training, but some typical questions that you want answers to is, what is the best of this person? What is the worst of them? Why did they leave, if indeed they have already left? Would you rehire them? Those are the kind of questions one learns to ask in skilled interviewing. In our experience, the two weaknesses in most interviewing is, first of all, the interviewer talks too much at the beginning of the interview, giving the interviewee clues as to what they're looking for. Better to leave most of the conversation in the early part of the interview up to the candidate and drawing them out to get as much information as you can, and not necessarily giving them a lot of help in the process. If you want to sell your organization or further explain the role and what's expected of the person, leave that till later in the interview. Another thing we've learned with hard experience is if you want to know a lot about the person's probable skills, education background, recent experience, there the resume can contribute, and they can certainly contribute in the interview. If you want to learn a lot about them as individuals, spend a lot of time asking them questions about their background. What did mom do? What did dad do? Basically, did you learn from both parents? Were they similar? Were they alike? There are some very fundamental things one learns through interviewing. It's beyond the scope of this presentation, but in my own experience, I've learned that it is very hard to find somebody that grew up in a rural area, particularly on a farm, that doesn't have a strong work ethic. Very seldom will we hire an ex-military person that doesn't have a sense of responsibility. So those are general guidelines, but through experience, becoming a skilled interviewer is really a part of getting smarter about the selection process. Once you've been through some initial fit and reference checking, you can get into evaluating mental aptitudes, personality, and skills. This is where the Achiever comes in, and the Achiever is unsurpassed not only in the quality, but also the efficiency and the cost effectiveness of the instrument. So in the Achiever, you're dealing with not only the mental aptitudes, practical personality characteristics, you're also getting a feeling for the validity of any particular profile. In our own business and achievement associates, depending on the job, we sometimes supplement other profiling instruments, but anything we do in profiling, the Achiever is, and I want to emphasize this, the Achiever is the core profiling instrument. As far as I'm concerned, it always will be. Sometimes when we're pursuing a very particular candidate for a leadership position, an important leadership position, we will use some of the measurable feedback instruments from Teleometrics International. If we're looking at a candidate who is going to have a part-time job, perhaps a summer employee at a community golf course, for example, we might use the PASS 3, which gives us a very inexpensive and quick look at trustworthiness, honesty, work ethic, etc. Anytime we use any supporting information, though, from other profiling instruments, it is always as a companion to our core profiling instrument, the Achiever. And that's what you're involved in this training process to learn about, is the Achiever. Once you get through step three in the funnel, if you're still referring to that, you will get into the structured interviewing, and then from your candidates, you will make a decision. One of the great challenges in selecting people is the more there is a need for the position to be filled, because things are not going well, because it is unfilled, the more pressure there is to make a selection. That pressure sometimes can lead to a very poor selection, and in the interest of immediacy, the organization ends up paying a higher price over time because they have a person in the position that simply cannot perform. Depending on the culture of the organization then can often compound the problem by not recognizing the mistake and dealing with it. No one likes to make a hiring mistake, find out they made a mistake, and then the candidate ends up suffering by losing their job. But many times when we make a mistake, the desire to be bent over backwards, to be fair to someone we hired, we leave the person in the job where they're not performing. I want to remind you of the Achievement Profiles motto, byline, whatever you want to call it, but it's basically that. What we're doing with the Achiever is matching people to positions for performance. Matching people to positions for performance. If you would, please turn now to page 5, the selection triad. Three things are involved in selection from the standpoint of an overview of where the data for the selection decision comes from. First, structured in-depth interviewing. Second, background and reference checking. And third, the Achiever itself and analysis. Among our clients, we often have discussions of when do you give the Achiever. Some of our clients give the Achiever to a candidate very early on in the selection process, and based on that, they decide whether or not to even go on with the other parts of the selection process. Other candidates choose to get involved in the in-depth interviewing, background checking, and so forth first, and then using the Achiever as sort of the final gate in whether or not to hire the person. The situation here is very much a function of the needs of the organization, the personality and culture of the organization. Generally speaking, I like the idea of using the Achiever early on and not wasting a lot of time in the interviewing process, particularly if the interviewing process involves relatively high-priced employees. The cost of the Achiever early on may tell you that not to pursue this candidate, in which that's a cost that you've lost, but interviewing the candidate by three or four executives and then doing the Achiever and finding out it's not a good fit is also very expensive, perhaps more expensive. How do these things work together? Each of the three components we're talking about, structured in-depth interviewing, background and reference checking, and the Achiever analysis, each plays an important part in the selection process. We believe without question that when you add the Achiever to structured in-depth interviewing and background check and reference checking, that you are significantly improving the odds of getting a good fit for the position. One of our clients says it this way. He said that selecting people is a lot more like gambling than accounting. That's exactly true. We don't know how to reduce selection to a numerical accounting process. it will always involve judgment. We just believe that when you add the achiever to the structured in-depth interviewing and the background check, you significantly improve the probability of getting a good fit. We agree that sometimes selection appears more like gambling than accounting, but I think when you use the achiever, you move it more towards accounting and less in the era in the direction of gambling. All three of the components that I talked about have advantages and disadvantages. What are the advantages of background and reference checking? The advantage there is that you cannot assume that people will turn over new leaves. You have to assume that their behavior has been in the past, it will continue to be. So the advantage of reference checking is if you can get some pretty good information, you already have a pretty good indication of whether this person can perform in the job. The disadvantage of the background and reference checking is sometimes it is very, very difficult to get good information. How about interviewing? Interviewing is a great area in which to build skills because you can learn a lot about interviewing through interviewing that you can't get anywhere else. You get a sense of not just the specifics of the person's background and their personality, but how do they seem to fit in with your culture now as you see it? So a lot of interviewing is not really that scientific, but does require a lot of intuition, gut feel, understanding of the culture you now have, a sense of the job, and so forth. Good interviewers tend to talk less and listen a lot. And that's probably the primary guideline I would give you on interviewing. What are the advantages of interviewing? All the things I just said. What are the disadvantages of interviewing? Many people who are doing interviewing are not skilled interviewers, have had no training, not a lot of experience. It is also true that there are candidates that can fool anyone. I want to repeat that. There are candidates that can fool anyone. So those are the pluses and minuses of interviewing. What are the advantages of the achiever? First of all, the information you get is statistically and data-based. The achiever measures what it proposes to measure. The biggest weakness in using the achiever is probably ties back to the structured in-depth interviewing in that one of the great pitfalls in hiring is people don't really know what they want. They want to hire somebody to fill the XYZ position, but if asked what are the specific needs within the XYZ position, they have trouble describing it. So many times we get a bad fit not because we don't get a measure on the person, because we don't really understand what we need or what we want. Each of the components in this triad had advantages and disadvantages. We have never, nor will we ever, market the achiever or any other personality profiling endeavor as the answer to everything. It never is, but it can certainly improve the probability of getting a good match of the person to the position. And that's really what we're after. We are asked many times what weight should be given to each of the three components, background reference checking, the achiever, or the in-depth interviewing. If I had to give an answer without any more information, I would say an average about one-third weight to each of them. However, the specific nature changes would change my answer. If this is somebody who you have tremendous referrals on, you have employees now that have worked with this person at their prior place of employment. You have access to a lot of information and data. Then the background and reference checking begins to take on more weight. If, on the other hand, you have a situation where it is very difficult to get information, then the reference checking part starts to lose weight. If you have skilled, experienced interviewers, that area of the triad tends to gain weight. If there's relatively limited experience among interviewers or limited knowledge of the nature of the work they're really hiring to, then the structured interview gets less weight. One thing I would emphasize is if you have a present employee that is applying for a position, which may be advancement or not, it could be lateral, but if you have an existing employee that is applying for a position, then immediately the role of the achiever is diminished to some degree, only because you have all kinds of evidence of this person's past behavior and their past performance. So in that case, the achiever would lose some of its relative weight compared to the other two legs of the selection triad. Nevertheless, the achiever is still an important part of the decision. This also leads me to the subject that one of the things that I admit to I am sometimes disappointed in, the achiever is a great tool for selection. And we really do believe it increases the probability of getting a good fit. Too many times our clients forget that once they have an employee who has taken the achiever, they have a great tool to help the development of that employee, to help them grow that employee over time, to help build that employee's capability to take on new roles in the organization. So if they have the achiever on the employee, they have a great built-in guideline on how to help that employee grow and improve their performance. Because from the achiever, they have certain strengths and weaknesses that showed up in the achiever related to the position, and they can use that to guide the development of the employee. Too many times we have clients that love the achiever in selection, would not hire anyone at any level without giving them the achiever, but then forget to use that in the development of the employee, or in unfortunate cases, troubleshooting some problems they might have with the employee. Hopefully those are significantly diminished by the use of the achiever. That's by way of background in the selection process and how the achiever fits in, and I certainly hope that that's been helpful to you. We're going to move now into getting into real understanding of the achiever, and we're going to start by covering the six practical mental aptitudes, and then we will move in this unit two, to cover at least some of the 10 personality dimensions. One thing that we will do next is cover this is in page 6 of your document. You will take a look at the Achiever Report summary form. Again, I'd like to emphasize that for this part of the discussion, you really need to refer to page 6 of the training program document. This is the Achiever Report summary form. It is not identical to the summary form that's included in the Achiever Report that is generated when you have someone log on and complete the Achiever, but it's a direct parallel of the form that appears as a part of the Achiever Report. And if you understand this form, which is specific to Achievement Associates, you'll also understand the form generated by the Achiever Report. You'll notice that there are six mental aptitudes near the top of the form, and then in the mid-range of the form, height-wise, you have the personality dimensions, and at the bottom you have two validity scales. What we will be doing in the rest of the Achiever training program, in this unit we're going to cover the mental aptitudes and get into a few of the personality dimensions. In Unit 3, we will cover the remaining personality dimensions and also the two validity scales that are included. You'll see those at the bottom of the Achiever Report summary form. And we'll be doing that in Unit 3. In Unit 4, we're going to take a family of actual achiever results and discuss those results to give you a sense of some advanced understanding of the achiever, where you not only learn what each dimension measures, you start to get a sense of how they relate to one another, and we'll cover as many possible patterns and combinations as time permits. So take a look now at the Achiever Report summary form. Again, the mental aptitudes near the top, the personality dimension, the center, validity scales at the bottom. Notice that across the form horizontally is a range of numbers 1 through 9 called the Stainine or Standard Ninth System. This is a German statistical system. It's related to the old bell-shaped statistical curve that you may have had in school at some point. Very important on the Achievement Associates form is at the bottom of the page, and you again see this on page 6, you will have the percentage of the population that falls within each stanon. If you picture the bell-shaped curve, each stanon represents a vertical cut down through the bell-shaped curve, where the area of that cut represents the percentage of the total population that falls within that stanon. If you look at the bottom of page 6, you'll see at stanon 5, you have 20% of the population. Stanon 5, all of these stanon cuts through the bell-shaped curve have equal width, but they have different heights. The center cut, meaning left to right, at the highest point of the bell-shaped curve, contains the most area, and that's 20% of the population. As you move out into the tails of the distribution, into each of the stanines, the percentage in each stanine, represented by the area of the cut, starts to diminish. So at stanine 4 and stanine 6, we have 17% of the population in each of those. At stanine 3 and stanine 7, we have 12% of the population in each of those. When we get out into the tails of the distribution, height is diminishing, and at stanine 2 and stanine 8, we only have 7% of the population. In the extreme stanines, in the tails left and right of the bell-shaped curve, we have only 4% of the population, 4 in 100 people, 1 in 25. The more you move towards the tail of distributions, from the standpoint of the personality profile, the more obvious the personality characteristic becomes. If you have someone who scores at stanine 8 on one of our dimensions called work habits, it will immediately be obvious to you that you're dealing with somebody that's highly structured, by the numbers, strongly organized. Just as if the person on that dimension scores at stanine 1, you will find that they are totally disorganized, totally unstructured. So the more towards the tails of the distribution, the more identifiable and recognizable the dimension. When we talk about other people, which we all do, we usually describe them in terms of some of their predominant characteristics. He is extremely forceful. She really cares about people. I'm not sure what he stands for. There's no doubt where he stands, etc. So we describe people in terms of their characteristics that are the most vigorous, are the most pronounced. So it's important to understand those numerics at the bottom of page 6, simply because all stanines are not equal. And as you start to use the Achiever, you appreciate that more and more. When you look at the individual dimensions, the title of the dimension is to the left. You then have a description to the left and to the right. The description on the left would be descriptive of somebody that's on the very low stanines to the left. The description on the right, the very high stanines to the right. There is a great deal of depth in measurement on all of the dimensions of the Achiever, the mental aptitudes, the personality dimensions, more than time would permit in this training program to go into. But what I will attempt to do, hopefully successfully, in the audios that follow in this unit and the next two units, I will cover things that will give you some reasonable in-depth understanding in each dimension, and try to make sure that I cover things that, based on my experience, you will be most interested in from the standpoint of hiring people for a certain job. There is an entire database behind the Achiever, as well as a database behind our own experience in Achievement Associates Incorporated, where we've been using the Achiever for 43 years. Those databases allow us to provide suggested ranges on each of the dimensions of the Achiever, provide suggested ranges for a specific job. Your job is to help us understand the requirements of the position. By describing it, job descriptions help, etc. In our firm, we've been around long enough that It doesn't take a long time to give us a feel for a job, because we've not only been involved in training and development with an enormous variety of positions, but we've certainly profiled people in a wide variety of positions. So the Achiever allows us to customize not the design of the Achiever, but the suggested ranges on each of the dimensions, the Stay 9 ranges, to customize those to the requirements of a specific position. With that as background, I'm going to move now to describing to you the 6 mental aptitudes. The first of the mental aptitudes, and also the most powerful of the mental aptitudes, is mental acuity. It measures 4 things: quickness to learn, judgment, problem-solving ability, and reasoning ability. I'll repeat those: quickness to learn, judgment, problem-solving ability, and reasoning ability. It is the most powerful, meaningful, and influential of the 6 mental aptitudes. When people are very quick to learn, they can certainly not only master, but also need to be quick to learn to handle certain kinds of jobs requiring a lot of technical expertise and or absorption of a lot of detail, etc. The more the job lacks repetitiveness, the more the job lacks a routine over and over aspect of the job, the more one needs to have someone with one of the higher positions on the Stay 9s on mental acuity. We need somebody with quickness to learn. We also get in that package, in most cases, problem-solving ability, good reasoning ability, etc. So for the very high Stay 9s, we need somebody in a challenging job with those characteristics. The reverse is not true for a job that is laden with routine work, a lot of repetition. In those jobs, the person needs to learn the job once, master it, have it locked in, and perform it effectively and efficiently. Many times in those kind of jobs, we actually need people on the lower half of the mental aptitudes. A person on the high mental aptitudes would be bored to death and demotivated in a job like that, where for somebody that's lower on the mental aptitudes, that job is just as challenging for them, although it has all that routine, it's just as challenging for them as a more complex job is for someone at the higher end of the scale. It is easy to fall into the trap of wanting to hire everybody in the organization that's in the upper half of the mental acuity score. That's a fallacy that we work continually in Achievement Associates to defeat. We are many times looking for people, for our clients, that are in extremely challenging jobs, and we want somebody in the higher Stay 9s on mental acuity. However, we're very sensitive to the fact that overkill here can be an equal problem. If we put somebody with very high mental aptitudes in a less demanding job, they will not perform well, their motivation will suffer. In fact, they'll wonder why they took the job. So you have to be careful, one has to be careful in assessing the mental aptitude requirement, the mental acuity requirement for the job. All jobs do not require people on the high end of the scale or certainly the low end of the scale. And in fact, many, many jobs can be handled well by people in the mid-range on this dimension. The next dimension is business terms. In many positions or jobs, we're not particularly, we don't need that dimension to the degree that we do in some others. But if we need somebody that is going to be dealing with business issues, either inside their organization or out, if we need somebody with a sense of how business works, then this dimension becomes more important. There's another way it serves us. If we have a resume that suggests a very strong business background from a candidate, but find out that on this dimension they score on the lower Stay 9s on business terms, it makes us wonder if we're looking at a valid resume or not. So this dimension can tend to back up and support what the person says on the resume. There are some positions and jobs, as I mentioned, that this is not an important dimension at all. We're not concerned with it. There are others where it's an important, very important dimension. One of the things it does tell us is it tells us whether or not the person has the business vocabulary to communicate effectively with other business people, either in their organization or perhaps outside. Business terms, a measure of somebody's knowledge of the language of business, and also to some degree a validation of their level of experience in the world of business. Memory recall, we prefer to call awareness. I want to emphasize that it became known as memory recall because the dimension itself, when somebody takes the achiever, is based on their knowledge of historical events. And if they have very strong knowledge of historical events, it tends to indicate that they are tuned in, they're aware of the world around them. That's really what we're after in measuring here. We're interested in the person's degree of awareness of the world around them. It's a measure in a way of their curiosity about things. If this person was a salesperson, it would be a measure of their tendency to have good prospecting awareness, using that as an example. There are many, many roles and many jobs where we need a lot of awareness of what's going on. And this can mean awareness of the world in general, awareness of our culture here in the United States, the awareness of what's going on in my own company, the awareness of what's going on in the community, if I happen to be a governmental agency, an awareness of what's going on with our customers. All of that awareness is extremely important. It is very hard for me today to think of jobs which favor a low level of awareness, or as the achiever labels it, memory recall. Most of the organizations that we're hiring into in most of the jobs need a high level of awareness, or as I like to call it, tuned inness. We need people that are tuned in. Again, there aren't too many jobs percentage-wise that suggest that we want a low level of awareness. Memory recall, we prefer to call it awareness, a measure of the degree to which the person is tuned in to the world around them. Next dimension is vocabulary. In most cases, it is the second most important or influential of the six mental aptitudes. Vocabulary is a measure of word knowledge in the English language. The basis of all of our communication lies more in language than anything else. And within that language, the more skill we have with the language, the more we tend to be an effective communicator. The issue with vocabulary is also that vocabulary, we know from using the achiever for years, vocabulary tends to develop in parallel to mental acuity. Usually on the achiever, the Stanine score on mental acuity and the Stanine score on vocabulary are within plus or minus one Stanine of each other, or they're identical because they do tend to develop together. People that are high on vocabulary have a strong component, a raw material for effective communication. It doesn't tell us whether or not they want to communicate. It doesn't tell us how good their interpersonal skills are and how they use them. All it tells us is, do they have the raw material to communicate from the standpoint of language? That's all it tells us, but in many cases, that's a lot. When people have very low vocabulary, they tend to have less tendency to communicate, and when they do communicate, they're not very effective with it. One of the things that I would call your attention to that is important to recognize is that when somebody has a very, very low vocabulary, the achiever is based on the English language. And this is a good time for me to mention also that there is a all-Hispanic achiever available too for clients or organizations where that's valuable. So there is an achiever that is entirely Hispanic. When you go back to vocabulary, when somebody scores in, let's say, the lower two Stanines on vocabulary, their vocabulary is so poor that their reading is actually marginal. Their reading is actually marginal. One of the things to always look at in an achiever is, if you have a vocabulary at Stainine 1 or 2, you need to take a look at mental acuity. And understand that on the achiever, the section which measures mental acuity, which has some 40 questions, is timed. If somebody has a very low vocabulary, most of the time, they also have a very low reading speed. And that low reading speed can handicap them in answering the questions on the part of the achiever that determines mental acuity. You cannot call this out with great precision. But generally speaking, if we have somebody that's a 1 or 2 on vocabulary, and we take a look at their mental acuity, and let's say it's Stainine 2 or 3, it is probable that their real mental acuity is 1 Stainine higher, maybe even 2 Stainines higher, because their mental acuity score has been handicapped by their low reading speed. Low vocabulary makes the precision of the mental acuity score questionable. So when you have very low vocabulary, you need to remember that and keep in mind that the mental acuity score may be valid right where it is, but on the other hand, it's probably at least a Stainine higher and maybe 2 Stainines higher. When we get into the personality dimensions in Unit 3 coming up, we will be spending a fair amount of time talking about not only learning the individual dimensions, but also idea of combinations of dimensions and how to read particular combinations. In the area of the mental aptitudes, there's not as much opportunity for looking at interactions. But one area that does come into play is vocabulary. If you have someone with very high awareness, remember, we're calling that dimension memory recall. We're calling that awareness. When we have a high level of awareness and also a very high vocabulary, you probably have a situation where the individual involved is a reader, and a lot of their awareness comes from reading. On the other hand, if you have a very high awareness score and a very low vocabulary score, or a generally low vocabulary score, that indicates somebody that is probably not a reader and acquires their awareness through the electronic media, movies, television, etc. Numerical perception, which should be called scanning accuracy, because that's what it is, this dimension measures vision and everything related to it. What we're really getting at is how accurately and how rapidly do people perceive visual information. It doesn't matter whether it's the world around them, it's video display terminal material, printed material. Anybody that has to handle a lot of data or information, this becomes an extremely important dimension. But it really measures scanning accuracy. And the measurement takes into account not only the eye and the optic nerve and the physical part of seeing, it also takes into account the part of the brain that processes visual information. So this appears to be a somewhat simple dimension. It is an output, but from the standpoint of what it's actually measuring, it's taking a look at vision combined with the processing of vision by the mind. So it's a very important dimension. People that are high on this dimension to the right can process in any kind of visual information accurately, rapidly, and without fatigue. People that are very low on this dimension would be very error prone. Processing that kind of information would be very difficult for them, they would be, again, would be very error prone. So it's an important dimension for a lot of jobs, certainly in industrial and quality control jobs. It can be very important. It's also important to understand that a very low score here can indicate some sort of a visual learning disability like dyslexia, etc. So if there's a very low score here, it can be attendant in the selection process to use other methods in interviewing, etc., to discuss the results here with the candidate to try to understand if there's any specific reason that they scored low on this dimension. And keep in mind, statistically, bell-shaped curve, the average person on this dimension scores in the mid-range. Again, if I were hiring somebody that had to process a lot of visual information, whether it's video display terminal material, printed material, the web, whatever, if they have to handle a lot of that information, this becomes a very important dimension because they will process that information rapidly, they will be relatively error-free, and they will not fatigue in the process, which is another important element of this. Mechanical interest measures the person's comfort level, experience, general sense of well-being in dealing with anything, technical, mechanical, physical principles, etc. The higher on the right on this dimension, the more the person's general aptitude to either be able to learn or work with physical, mechanical things, physical, mechanical concepts. And of course, in our ever-evolving technological world here, this is becoming even more important. There are some positions where this is not an important dimension at all, obviously. There are others where it's extremely important. If you are hiring a forklift operator or a plant operator in a distribution warehouse where they're going to have to run a forklift and handle a lot of other mechanical, perhaps packaging equipment, this becomes a very significant dimension. If the position we're looking for is a lingerie salesperson, I'm not sure this is quite as important. So that's a summary of the mental aptitudes. The most important, mental acuity, quickness to learn, judgment, problem solving, and reasoning ability. Secondly, business terms, knowledge of the language of business tends to validate that experience. Memory recall, remember this is awareness, the degree to which people are tuned into the world around them. Vocabulary, the raw material of effective communication. Numerical perception, the ability to process visual information accurately, rapidly, and without fatigue. And mechanical interest, the ability to work with, understand, learn physical and mechanical things, physical phenomena, etc. So those are the six important mental aptitudes of the achiever. When laying out these audios, it was my perception that by the end of this section, I might get to the couple of the 10 personality dimensions. That's not the case. I'm about out of time now, so we'll hold off on the 10 personality dimensions until we get to Unit 3. I appreciate your involvement in this unit, and I hope you were also involved in Unit 1. If you got through this unit, did not do Unit 1, I'd suggest you go back to Unit 1 at some time. Appreciate your involvement and interest. And I look forward to talking to you again in Unit 3. And in Unit 3, we're going to cover all of the personality dimensions probably the validity scales as well. I think you'll find the discussion of the individual 10 individual personality dimensions fascinating information. Thank you again for joining us.